Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
New York State is facing the largest budget gap in several years. The $6.1 billion deficit is due largely to higher costs for Medicaid, the health insurance program for low-income people. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt with more.
The problem began late in the last fiscal year when Governor Andrew Cuomo's budget officials delayed one of the state's monthly Medicaid payments to providers worth $1.7 billion for 3 days in late March. That's so it would instead count in the new fiscal year that began in April. Since then, the gap has grown even worse. A November report by the governor's budget office estimates the deficit to be between $3 and $4 billion and recommends again delaying this fiscal year's final $2 billion Medicaid payment. The rest of the gap could be made up through across-the-board cuts to hospitals, nursing homes, and other health care providers, the budget office says. Cuomo has not yet committed to a specific plan to fill the gap.
It's nothing we haven't addressed before, but it is serious. It's basically caused by the Medicaid shortfall, which is caused by a reduction in payments from the federal government. Medicaid is joint local, state, federal program, and the federal government has cut back on their Medicaid reimbursement. Labor costs have gone up. That's driving a deficit.
The state's increase in the minimum wage, as well as pay hikes in recent union contracts, have driven up labor costs for hospitals and nursing homes, as well as home health care companies. In addition, more New Yorkers now have health insurance through Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Legislative leaders who will have a say in the final state budget plan are not on board with health care cuts. Senate Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins says state cuts to Medicaid spending can trigger even deeper reductions because state aid is linked to federal and local money for the program. And the Democratic majority leader questions the governor's self-imposed 2% per year state spending cap. Cuomo was trying to keep within that limit when his budget office delayed the Medicaid payment earlier this year.
This is an opportunity to take a look in terms of some of these self-imposed caps. And again, I think everybody understands the importance of being prudent with taxpayer dollars. I mean, it's not, something that we take lightly.
Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie says he'd consider raising revenues before cutting aid to the needy.
Unless money's going to fall from the sky, you're always going to have to try to do things. And so when there's a concern about having enough money, the two options always are, do you cut spending or do you raise revenue? And for us in the Assembly, we always believe in raising revenue.
Michael Kink with Strong Economy for All, which is funded by unions and advocacy groups for the homeless and lower-income New Yorkers, says the state has numerous billionaires and multinational corporations, and he says they can afford to pay more in taxes.
There has been an explosion of wealth and income at the very top. We could do taxes only on billionaires, ultra-millionaires, huge corporations, not touch any working people at all, close the deficit, and make the investments we need to make for New York's future.
Kink and other advocates plan to protest outside a fundraiser in New York City on Wednesday night for the governor's birthday. They were planning to bring a cake decorated with frosting that spelled the hashtag #MakeBillionairesPay. A senior advisor to Governor Cuomo, Rich Azzopardi, says the protest won't influence tax policy.
Mike Kink and his merry band of special interest-funded mimes and puppeteers revive the same tired show every year. And budget decisions are made on the merits, not as a result of performance art.
For now, the governor is silent on whether new taxes or spending cuts are needed to close the deficit, saying everyone will just have to wait until he gives his budget address in January. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Thank you.
are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Alan, this week it became official. The commission, that's the Public Finance Commission in New York, released its 144-page report Sunday night. It detailed its recommendations for how campaigns will be funded in New York through a system of taxpayer funds matched to lower contribution rates and tougher thresholds for parties, third parties, specifically the issue to achieve ballot access that could spell trouble for those minor ballot lines. You have spoken with the representative, the co-chair of the Working Families Party, Karen Scharf. This week, you spoke with the head of the Conservative Party, Gerard Jerry Kassar, about what's going on here, and politics makes strange bedfellows as the two lawsuits from these two minor parties have been joined together by a judge. Although they agree on the issue of the threshold for the ballot, they're not in agreement on the public financing aspect of it.
Well, obviously, Republicans and conservatives have never liked public financing of campaigns because they feel it will give the Democrats an advantage. And the truth of the matter is it will, because Republicans as a party have an awful lot of deep pockets that they can use to run elections with. If you have public financing, as New York City does, it clearly will help the Democrats. I happen to think that's a good thing as long as it's fair, as long as everybody has the same access to the money. Nevertheless, you can be sure that the Conservative Party and the Republican Party aren't all that overjoyed about it. Now as to the other issue. I have a new nickname for Governor Cuomo, who has done some remarkable things as governor. Very strong performance, works very hard, works 24/7. You got to give him a hand for that. On the other hand, this guy is truly tough guy, Andrew. And he doesn't forget when people cross him. And the Working Families Party has supported candidates against him in primaries and elections. And the fact is that he can't stand that. I believe that's the case. And so he comes up with his close ally, vassal, Sancho Panza, Jay Jacobs, who is the chair of the Democratic Party and for some reason gets put on the commission. Can you imagine the chair of the Democratic Party is on the commission, which is supposed to be studying this? A little bit lopsided, I suspect. In any case, they come up with these, it's a Yiddish word, or maybe I shouldn't be using it, but for shlugana. And what it means is, at least the way I think it means is, you know, it's crazy. It's a crazy idea that you would make it harder to get a ballot line. That's because that's the way you punish your enemies for past transgressions, and I believe that's what's going on. Well, they've got a case in court. They say they're constitutionally protected. We'll see. We do know that judges have a way of being obsequious when it comes to powerful people, like a governor. So we'll see how that goes. I hope I'm wrong about that last assertion. But it's clear that they're doing everything in their power to drive these parties out of power, more so the Working Families Party than the Conservative Party, I suspect.
What's your sense that the legislature would come back and change that? We hear that Speaker Hastie thinks that the threshold should be tougher.
Look, Speaker Hastie's a Democrat, too. The idea that, you know, first of all, talk about obsequious. I think Speaker Hastie in this case is really folding to the governor. I think that's clear because I do know that a letter was sent, signed by many, many state legislators saying that this whole thing was not good. So the speaker seems to be siding with the governor as opposed to his own people in this. If the speaker doesn't want them to come back to change this, they're not coming back. It's that simple.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. A Dutchess County resident who's an advocate for policy reform around military sexual trauma says new legislation in New York concerning veterans is trailblazing. Her work and her story helped inspire the legislation that Democrat Dee Dee Barrett sponsored in the State Assembly. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn picks up the story.
The bill that New York Governor Andrew Cuomo signed on Veterans Day is a national first. It extends the eligibility for state benefits to veterans who have received a less than honorable discharge because of unfair or discriminatory discharge policies.
I am ecstatic to hear that that change has finally been implemented. For me personally, it's been a really long journey. I am a veteran and survivor of military sexual trauma.
U.S. Marine Corps veteran Janelle Mendez says she experienced another of the unfair or discriminatory discharge policies, post-traumatic stress disorder.
Going through that storyline and that struggle, in my case, like, I didn't know that I would be reporting sexual violence, and then all of a sudden, I would be coming out homeless, not even knowing I was getting discharged, and then I go to apply for benefits, and I found out I don't qualify. So in my case, it took me 2 years to get out of homelessness, and it wasn't until I got a job in finance and when I started working at a bank where I even started making enough money to pull myself out of homelessness. And it took 2 years to do that. And at the same time, I was dealing with so much trauma from what had happened. So I was going through PTSD, which I did not know I had at the time. And I didn't even know you can get PTSD from sexual violence. And I started to get involved in substance abuse. So like I had a really, really hard time when I got out. And I just felt like no one was able to help me. And I felt like I was ignored by everybody that I was going to for help. So, you know, this legislation getting changed to me is a huge marker in saying, you know, as a community, we're taking a stand and we're saying that enough is enough and that we're going to protect those who come next.
The New York law also extends eligibility for state benefits to veterans who received a less than honorable discharge for traumatic brain injury or their sexual orientation or gender identity under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Assemblymember Dee Dee Barrett represents the 106th District, which includes portions of Dutchess and Ulster counties.
It makes people who received bad papers because of bad military policies eligible to get their honor restored and their benefits under New York state law restored.
Mendez says she had to go through a lengthy process with Veterans Affairs to prove she experienced sexual violence and that her discharge was directly correlated with the violence. And while she was successful, Mendez says she intends to take advantage of the new law in New York, the Restoration of Honor Act, to access additional benefits. Barrett, who chairs the Assembly Committee on Veterans Affairs, says there was some pushback when she first started working on the bill, but not from the legislature.
Initially, it required some conversations with some of the old guard, military organizations, or, you know, certain individuals. But I think everybody, you know, whatever battle and whatever war you fought in, knows people who are struggling with PTSD. I think people are increasingly aware of military sexual trauma and how it's impacted women and men, and how challenging that is. If, for example, you're, you know, called into a meeting with somebody who was your attacker and you have to deal with that, and people handle things in different ways.
Democrat Brad Hoylman of the 27th District sponsored the bill in the Senate.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
And a report out shows many working American families are spending more and more of their income on health care. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas explains.
The Commonwealth Fund report, Trends in Employer Health Care Coverage, 2008 through 2018, Higher Costs for Workers and Their Families, finds health insurance premium costs and deductibles have been growing faster than median income in all states over the last decade. Commonwealth Fund President David Blumenthal says that as the 2020 campaign season progresses, health care is clearly a top concern.
Health care and health insurance coverage are essential to people's well-being and financial security, and yet employer health care coverage is leaving millions of families exposed to high and potentially unaffordable costs. Ensuring that everyone can afford their health care will require policy fixes and system-wide efforts to get to the heart of the health care cost problem.
Sarah Collins co-authored the report for the nonprofit. She says it is based on the latest data from the insurance component of the Federal Medical Expenditure Panel survey.
The reason we wanted to look at people's insurance costs relative to income is that research indicates that these costs have consequences. People with low and moderate incomes may go without insurance if it competes with other expenses like housing or food. and high deductibles may lead people to skip needed health care or not fill prescriptions. What we found is that average annual growth and the combined cost of employees' contributions to premiums and deductibles outpaced growth in U.S. median income between 2008 and 2018 in every state. This means that premium contributions and deductibles in employer plans took up a growing share of people's incomes over that time period. Those costs together accounted for 11.5% of median household income by 2018, up from 7.8% a decade earlier.
The report shows nationwide the average deductible for a middle-income family amounted to 4.7% of income in 2018, up from 2.7% in 2008. Collins points out that the Commonwealth Fund defines underinsured as having a deductible equivalent to 5% or more of income, an amount exceeded in many southern states.
Democratic presidential candidates have proposed a range of options to improve insurance affordability and lower health care costs, which are the key driver of premiums. Some proposals would build on the Affordable Care Act and provide people in employer plans with an option to enroll in a public plan like Medicare. Others propose to replace the Affordable Care Act and all private insurance, including employer coverage, with a public plan like Medicare and eliminate all premiums and cost sharing. Republican reform ideas are less well developed at this point, but tend to favor replacing the Affordable Care Act with market-oriented approaches and more state control over insurance markets and the Medicaid program. We are certain to hear more from candidates and likely voters on health care affordability issues in the coming year.
The report noted that the average annual employee premium contribution for single coverage trends higher across northeastern states, with New York, Vermont, Massachusetts, and Connecticut well above the $1,427 U.S. average. Massachusetts ranks highest at $1,903. You can read the entire report at wamc.org.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Most of the attention has been on President Trump's re-election campaign in the Democratic primary, but third parties are also getting ready for 2020. Howie Hawkins is the co-founder of the U.S. Green Party. He has unsuccessfully run for governor in New York three times and U.S. Senate once. In 2016, Hawkins was the Green Party's candidate for vice president, and he's now the party's candidate for president. On a visit to Plattsburgh, Hawkins told Pat Bradley he was drafted by the Greens across the country to run.
Well, I have a lot of respect for the people that asked me and looked around and didn't see other Green candidates capable of pulling off a national campaign. None of them have even run a statewide campaign. And so the Greens need a candidate, and so it seemed to fall in my lap.
Any party that's not Republican or Democratic tends to be referred to as a third party. Do you see anything changing for third party and third party candidates in the U.S.?
Well, the goal we have in the Green Party and in my campaign is to appeal to those people who are voting in low numbers, working class people, people of color, young people. And those people think they're apathetic. I've done so much door knocking. These people are alienated. They're not apathetic. I know a guy that he's never registered to vote. He's a Teamster I work with. I tried to get him for 17 years working there to get him to register. And he just said, no, those two parties don't care about me. I'm not going to play their game. But every time there was an issue in the news, he'd come running to me. What do you think? What's going on? You know, he was following it. He just wasn't voting because he felt, you know, none of these parties represent him. So if the Green Party is going to have a future, it's going to be organizing and mobilizing that, you know, about half the population doesn't vote in presidential elections and more in other elections. So that's, you know, how we change the political system, I think, from the Green Party perspective. We get those people engaged, supporting us, and then we have a multi-party democracy. We're the third major party.
Well, Howie Hawkins, you're traveling around the country. We keep hearing about how divided it is, the blue and the red. Do you see that blue-red split?
It's not subtle at all. It's a class divide. It's the working class people and the struggling middle class people against these elites and the wealthy elites that fund those two major parties. That's the real divide. And the problem is, as we like to say, the bosses got two parties. We need one of our own because we're just not getting represented and covered in the politics we see. So you have two elite factions that, you know, fight over, you know, who's get the spoils. But in the end, they agree, for the most part, on foreign policy. Our economic policies have generated growing inequality for 45 years, whether it was, you know, the Bushes or Clinton and Obama. Not much difference in their economic policies. And that's why we need an alternative. And so that's why I think the divide is more up and down than what they call the left, the Democrats, and the right, the Republicans, who are both, I think, you know, center-left, center-right establishment parties.
Well, the other thing that we can't turn away from basically right now are the impeachment hearings. Is that making voters more receptive to candidates outside of the two major parties? Are they turning to the Green Party and to your ideas, Howie?
I don't think impeachment is driving people to us. You know, my question about impeachment is, why did it take the Democrats so long? I mean, long before this Iran or Ukraine scandal came up, there was the blatant racism of Trump. He told people break laws, you know, like on the border patrol or cops in Long Island, you know, rough them up before you put them in the squad car, and says, I'll pardon you if you get in any trouble. That's lawlessness, abuse of power up and down all over, plus all the corporate crimes. I mean, his rap sheet goes back decades and it's a mile long. And the emoluments, you know, self-enrichment, using his office for him and his family. I mean, all those things were completely impeachable. And what really frustrated me was, you know, Nancy Pelosi in the House, the speaker saying, oh, we can't impeach, it'll divide the country. This president divides the country every time he opens his mouth. You know, but the problem is, I think the guy should be impeached, but the next guy up in line isn't going to be much better. And so we need more than impeachment. We got to change the system.
Howie Hawkins, as president, how would you bring the country back together, and what kind of issue priorities would you move forward with while doing that?
Well, I would bring people together around a program that I got elected on. And the top three issues, which I consider life and death issues, are the climate emergency, the inequality crisis. We now have a 20-year life expectancy gap between our richest and poorest counties. Inequality kills, and it's been getting worse for 45 years, and neither of the two major parties has a program to deal with that. We call for an economic bill of rights. Actually, Roosevelt called for that in 1944 and 1945 in his State of the Union addresses. He asked Congress to enact it. They never have. That's a job guarantee, a guaranteed income above poverty, the right to affordable housing, to comprehensive health care, to a lifelong public education, and a secure retirement. And we have detailed programs for those things. If you look at the polls, those are the issues, particularly right now, medical bills. You know, so many people at the end of the month, you know, they got to choose between rent, utilities, and groceries, and God forbid you get a medical bill. And, you know, that's as many as half the people in the country. So that's the first issue on their mind. And then there's another issue that's not being talked about by any of the major party candidates, and that's this new nuclear arms race. We've got out of all these nuclear arms control treaties. We're modernizing our nuclear forces, making the strategic missiles hypersonic. That means six times faster, which puts them even more on a hair trigger alert. And we're putting more tactical nukes into conventional forces, as if you can, you know, shoot some tactical nukes off and it won't escalate into a strategic nuclear war that destroys us all. So we're calling for a pledge of no first use, a minimum credible deterrent, so we unilaterally disarm to a minimum credible deterrent, and then on the basis of those tension-reducing measures, go to the nuclear powers of the world and say, we got to get rid of nuclear weapons. There was a treaty adopted by 122 nations 2 years ago in the UN called the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. The campaign for the abolition of nuclear weapons got that through, and they got the Nobel Peace Prize for that 2 years ago. So those are the top three issues that are, you know, we're trying to get covered and addressed.
You can hear the full interview with Green Party presidential candidate Howie Hawkins.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1949. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.